the number of skills you needed to work in the US economy went from 10 to about 20. So you needed to double your skills. The original 10 skills are kind of falling off. You needed 10 new skills to be relevant for that job. I see that exponentially growing.
Welcome to the Learn It All podcast with your hosts, Learn It CEO, Damon Lemby, and SVP of Product, Darren Bridget. Our mission is to explore how continuous growth shapes the path to success. Our guests are high achievers who've learned there's always something new to discover. They'll share their stories, strategies, and insights with you. So whether you're a budding entrepreneur, a seasoned executive, an aspiring athlete, or simply someone who believes in the lifelong pursuit of knowledge, this podcast is for you. Join us now for the latest episode as we continue the Learn It All's journey through a world that never stops teaching.
Did you know that the global upskilling and reskilling market is about a half a trillion? That's $1 trillion a year and growing annually at 10%. Welcome to the Learn It All podcast. I'm Damon Lemby and my co-host is Darren Bridget. And on our show today is a former baseball player, intelligence officer, and now CEO of One Range, Steve Gilman. Steve, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys. Happy Friday, and so glad I'm here to chat with you today. It's going to be fun.
Absolutely.
So, Steve, I want to get into a little bit of your background, but you know, me as a former baseball player as well, how did you and I get here? How did we get to this, to being in the never my wildest dreams? I think we'd be in the learning and development world, but here we are.
David, have you heard the baseball is like a virus? You got to get it out of your system. So you play as long as you can. And then listen, we're salty former athletes who just love the creativity of building businesses. And obviously we have a passion for upskilling and making sure people are empowered, not much different than we were when we were playing baseball on a team of 20, 30 people, upskilling every day, all day. It just happened to be on a baseball field, not on a computer.
It's awesome. Why pivot into learning exactly? I mean, it seems like there's a lot we could draw connections with your baseball career and the success that you have right now. And again, we're going to be getting way into like training and learning and all that stuff, but am I right? You have kind of like a finance background a little bit too. Like you were starting down other paths and you saw this big opportunity in learning with One Range.
Yeah, that's right. So I, a little bit of a non-traditional background. That's what they call it where I went to business school. So when I was 28, everyone said, you have a very path. Like, where's the focus? Very disciplined in everything I've done, but I had an engineering degree. I played professional baseball for a few years. I was an intelligence officer. Heck, in my off-season of baseball, I was an engineer working R&D for Johnson & Johnson. And then I went to business school and I learned what I love the most is actually learning and being challenged every day. So I went into the startup world and I built and sold a company in the live event space as a challenge. And of course, in entrepreneurship, you're learning every day, every angle of team management, of people management, of investor relations and sales and everything else. And when I had the opportunity 2 years ago to figure out really what I wanted to do with the rest of my life, I got with my co-founder and CTO, Hutan, who builds amazing technology, and just said, like, what's been missing? Like, why aren't we just content doing one thing, working for one big company, and just applying our skills? And what we saw missing was intellectual stimulation and the ability to upskill, continuously learn. Naturally, you get it as a founder, but holy cow, like, if him in technology and me kind of with an idea about the business model and the opportunity, if we can deploy that worldwide and scale it, not only do we get to empower people, which is a personal passion, but we do it by helping them learn. Like, maybe there's an opportunity. And so once we started getting into it and learning about the market and what tech tools existed and didn't, I mean, that's it. And we don't think about anything in the future. So this had to be an idea that we were going to take and run with for the next 10 to 20 years. And upskilling is just something we couldn't get away from after kind of first thinking about it.
I like what you said earlier about, you know, from playing baseball. And I felt the same way. In baseball, you're constantly upskilling. You have to have learning agility. I mean, I think you were a pitcher. I was a hitter. But, you know, you strike out, you need to adapt and learn and maybe get some feedback from your coach and move on really quickly. What did you learn? You know, and then I want to get into, tell us a little bit more about One Range, but what did you learn as far as becoming a leader from both your baseball career and also as an intelligence officer?
Yeah. So I guess I'll try to encapsulate the professional baseball. And when I was an intelligence officer, I worked mostly with Navy special warfare SEAL teams doing counterproliferation. Those guys are upskilling every day, all day, right? For the 1% of their deployment that it's going to matter the most, of course. And so I think what you learn in those types of environments is business can be a little bit harder than what they do. And I don't say that with too much, but as a leader, what's very defined in baseball or in missions is a goal of where you want to go. And how you, so you win the World Series. If you win the games, you score more points, more runs, all of that stuff. It's easier to get a team working towards that general direction and lead within that construct that's already set for you. In the business world, and I'll relate this to people's careers and how they upskill, the goals are not defined for us. What makes you happy? Money, productivity, flexibleness, working for the folks that I want to, all that stuff, it's not as defined. So when we go into this world of figuring out through the creative lens of what we're supposed to be doing in life, in the corporate world, everything we've been educated for, it's not as simple. Now, there's tough moments in baseball and the military and everything else, but you learn through constructs. Now everybody's kind of on their own to figure out what they want to do. And there's a lot of opinions of what should get you there. I think, you know, there's no better way to understand and assess people in sports and how they react. David, what you said, I didn't strike out a lot, but that's because I never hit. I would have struck out if they put me up there. But the micro adjustments. So mental toughness in front of teammates, in front of coaches. Why does it matter when you have mental toughness in front of other teams? That kind of stuff is hard to figure out in the business world, or at least do it in a microcosm. In one game, you can learn so much about yourself and teammates, whereas in business, it's going to take some time, right? And so just a great way to kind of get an introduction to what the real world's going to be like.
Great. So let's get into the upskilling. Tell us a little bit more about OneRange.
Yeah. So OneRange is an intelligent upskilling platform. We connect companies and their employees to world-class learning providers across the globe in any format. Courses, conferences, live courses, books, everything that people use to upskill and learn. And so the original thesis was there's so many barriers between employees and the actual high-quality training they need that we should develop a tech tool that allows them to get to it immediately, remove the barriers, approval, discovery, if there's payments and reimbursements, real access in real time that fits what they need to do. And so we rely on kind of three core pillars. One, we use data analytics and AI to have a seamless user experience. Two, we're provider agnostic, which means the right content is there and it's individualized so the person can find it. And so we're a marketplace by nature. And then third, we're here to pass an ROI to businesses. So the analytics and the transparency, intelligence, if you will, has to be in place for companies to understand and actually sponsor all this activity. So we excel in all three, and that's where we've seen our success.
That's it's interesting that you came into this marketplace and saw this sliver of opportunity here. I mean, we certainly see this as a training company that knowledge workers, trying to help knowledge workers out there, like you said, not having a super clear goal, and they're motivated to learn, but there's this disconnect where they're not, it's not getting across the finish line for them, right? Yeah. And so you're finding and this opportunity to come in here and make a difference. Why do you think, based on your business, what you see, like, why does this disconnect even happen in the first place?
Yeah, it's a great question, Darren. So Hutan, my co-founder and I, when we sat in a room and we started the business, we had a shared experience, right? We had a passion for upskilling. We saw the business model, the potential. We had a shared experience. The Department of Defense did a tuition reimbursement for a graduate degree I have. The Lockheed Martin, where Hutan worked in his early years, did a tuition reimbursement program for his master's degree. Both of those programs are supposed to be intended to help upskill and get their top talent to the next place so they continue to lead within the organization. Great business case for it, right? You can hire internally and promote internally. Both of the programs that we went through were such stressors on us as individuals that it wasn't serving its purpose. So for me, I wasn't given a choice what grad school I went to or what program I had. It was just take it or leave it. The administrative process was they paid the provider directly, the university, but the last semester, the HR person left and the provider never got paid. So I had to pay it out of pocket, right? So administrative issues. And as a young person, that's it's harder to stomach. And for Hutan, he had a system where he would get reimbursed, but it wasn't until he showed he got an A or B in the class. And so there's a 4-month cycle from September to December where he always got an A, but he wouldn't get reimbursed for it. So he's floating tens of thousands of dollars on a credit card and taking personal loans, right? And so the realization there was, oh my God, the companies are spending money trying to do this, but one, there's too many barriers. And if we weren't the alphas, like give us this training, give us this training, give us the training, we wouldn't have got it. Two, payment issues and terms. The company wants to sponsor it, should be an easy way. And then three, it has to be open. I went to a school that I never wanted to go to school to, Florida Institute of Technology.
Yeah.
It's a great institution. I didn't choose it. And by partnership, it was actually more expensive than the school I wanted to go to.
Yeah.
Once I finished that degree, I quit the government. And then I paid for my own degree at Columbia Business School, which is where I originally wanted to go. And you know, similar things with Hutan, where he left before he was allowed to, but they didn't reimburse him on time and everything else. And so we looked at that business model and said, there's lots of degree programs out there. They're great. But what does everyone in the workforce need and is asking for? And companies already spend money on professional development, short form courses, books, conferences. And so we focused the business model around that. And since we've started the company and launched the platform, we've been nothing but spoiled in employees getting access to what they need and then achieving success. So we just believe ourselves to have a tech platform that lowers barriers and employees do it. That's why we talk about no learning motivation issues, yeah, right? It's administrative or approvals, things like that that get in the way.
It's funny the what you're describing. I never really thought about it this way, but when you describe it like that, it's like, oh yeah, that model of like reimbursing people was built back from when like they still had fins on cars. Like that's a super old model that doesn't really fit in today's fast paced, you're always connected sort of workforce. Which is actually one of those other things I wanted to ask you about, because I always feel like this is part of the issue when it comes to people saying, you know, what do you care about? Training. I want training. I want professional development opportunities. And it doesn't need to be like PhDs. We had a great guest on yesterday who's got a PhD and was saying like certification is really good. And just like get that in just in time training that you need.
Yep.
But part of the issue is that people recognize that it's important, but it's not urgent enough. And they have a lot of competing needs and all, you know, everybody's super busy. And so because it's like, it's important, but I can't get it into my Eisenhower matrix because there's just not enough urgency with doing the training. Do you see that? Do you have recommendations for people about how to address that?
Yeah, it's a great question. So nowhere in my background do I have a learning and development background, right? I've never served in a people ops or HR role. So the way we look at it as employees or operators of former businesses that just wanted their people to get what they needed.
Yeah.
Learning and development can be compliance and internal training. Due date, going to be boring, minimum requirements to sit in your seat. Got it. And then there's upskilling, right? Actually gaining the skills, knowledge, tools, everything to advance yourself and obviously what you do for the company strategy. Now, when you talk about upskilling and we talk about removing barriers, the barriers we remove are not just the administrative and the payment, but also the flexibility. So how do I learn at my point in the career? When I was a 22-year-old, I would have taken courses, got certificates, posted them on LinkedIn. When I was 30 years old, I was deep into reading knowledge from mentors and people I'd never get a chance to meet about business. Now I take this podcast, I download it, and I listen to it on the subway because I live in New York. And so I get a daily dose, almost an hour worth every day, but I do it either that way or I go to executive education 2 days a year, get in and get out. And so people change throughout their career. People at businesses are different. We're a remote environment, right? So live courses and flexible courses are part of that. And the other answer is like, why now and why do people actually need this stuff? If you remove the barriers, you'll actually see that what looks like compliance, say for an engineer or a financial analyst, is actually something they have to do that the company may not know about. An example would be an engineer that needs to upskill and get a certificate in AWS just to work on the platform. And so the younger generation's coming out of college and saying, whoa, like the half-life of my skills is 4 to 6 months. I've met people that graduated Columbia with engineering, just because I was up there the other day, that in the fall are going to a job and they're wondering if they have the skills to keep up. And so the sense of urgency from the employee level, and those are the employees you want, they will do it. They have to do it to remain competitive.
I think you bring up a great point. I mean, with AI and everything else, I mean, the half-life of skills, I like the analogy I heard you say before. You know, you get done with college, graduate in May or June, and then by the beginning of 2025, you need all new skills. So that is great. That's important. But let's look at it from the lens of organizations. Now, a lot of organizations understand the value of learning and development, and they want to build learning cultures. That's really what we want to do with our customers, is help them build learning cultures. But for those industries, excuse me, not industries, but companies out there who look at it as maybe more of a luxury, which I disagree with, I think it's something they have to do. Why do companies and organizations need, why is it critical that they invest in learning development for their team?
Yeah, it's a great question. And here over the past few years, we've seen swings in the market, right? Where there's cash to go around. So the C-suite's approving more, and then there's not cash to go around. And so the C-suite's approving less. I will say the companies we work with and what we've noticed in the industry that have upskilling programs have not 1 cent pulled away from investing in their people. If you're doing it the right way, right? If you're investing in your people, you're seeing the results and the impact, that becomes critical. Where I think we see this whole, you know, it's an elective thing, and if we have learning development, that's fantastic. If people get skills from us, that's amazing. These people that don't have the right programs in place. And I don't blame them. That's most of the industry. That's why we're founders in the industry. But if you've had a simple LMS and some kind of tool that's just not getting your folks there, that's going to be easy to cut, no matter how many business cases you put in front of them. When you're actually deriving productivity, attracting the right people, and retaining top talent because you're giving them intellectual stimulation and professional development, you're never going to pull that away. You can't. It's no longer a perk or a benefit. It is mission critical. And the customers that we're building with and developing for that have that program continue to invest more and more. And it comes from, you don't see this too often in the learning world, right? But like positive feedback from users and people who are taking the right courses. 10, 20 years ago, people would take the courses they have to get to the next level. Now, technology moves so fast, people are not comfortable unless they're productive and ahead of where they need to be. So the ROI for the business case is very simple when it comes down to individuals. But if you're going to pay someone to be on your team, be part of your culture, and they're going to get a six-figure salary in technology, you should be investing 2 to 6% in their learning and development, but with stuff that hits the high-quality training that they want. And that's where you deliver productive, profitable business impact.
Can you give us an example? I want to go back to what you said earlier. An example of a company developing and implementing a training program the right way.
Yeah. Excellent question. So we concentrate a lot on the SMB market. We have a customer. We just went through a case study with them, Kalent. They're an IT consulting firm, heavy technology, based in a bunch of different countries, but their base is here in California. They built a company when they were 200 people. That program was basically bringing on one range, deploying individual effective pay-as-you-go upskilling for all of their employees. And what happens is naturally, when you have a small HR team or a small training team or a training team at all, you have to delegate the responsibility of upskilling for the employee or the manager, right? And those two working together. So if I'm an engineer, I'm working with my manager to find the next best scores and resources and whether they're productive. We like this market because the HR and learning teams are constrained quite a bit. They're not able to build larger teams and do internal training. So these companies are relying on external training. Kalent has now grown to above 500. They're heading on a path towards 1,000 in the past 2 years and continue to grow. And what they see, because they traditionally had a professional development stipend program, spend what you want, we'll reimburse you with not a lot of activities. They've had 9x engagement. They've had 5 times better use of spend and visibility, and they've had twice the amount of retention. So not to share their numbers if they're not in the case study, but they've reduced their churn by half, which is a big deal when you're recruiting engineers. And so I think the thing we're most proud of is there's one person on the training team there. She does an amazing job. She scaled her vision through our software and kind of the idea behind it globally. And as they continue to scale, they don't have to bring on more people to do internal training or build content. They're relying on external providers. And that's a great success story.
Yeah. Steve, one of the things that you've met, and clearly you're a good data guy. and this is, you know, traditionally a qualitative kind of feel. Like it feels hard to measure the ROI. You're out there, you're an HR leader, you're an L&D leader, you want to get some investment in training. Then the people actually make the decisions about where to spend money said, you know, people want the training, we're spending money on training, they say they need it, but I mean, how do we know we're really getting benefit here? Like I could measure, okay, maybe people are using it, maybe they say they like it, but like, how do you really know you're getting a good spend for your dollars? How do you solve this problem of measuring training?
Yeah. So in two ways that I would, I love talking to companies about how they do upskilling because there's no one best way ever, yeah. Right? Yeah. But it's up to the company culture, and the ability to optimize it over time. That's why we believe in software, right? Having data, because things can change in your program. Bring in different vendors as you onboard new teams, things change as they should. We look at it kind of in two ways. One, you have to have the alignment of, let's go to that. When we survey companies or we ask companies to survey themselves, the most important questions are, do people feel empowered? Are they getting the skills? And when you survey managers, are they getting feedback that the HR team is not getting feedback? And by the way, we just did a study with SHRM where we pulled executives and then HR directors and above and basically asked them what they thought of their upskilling programs.
Yes.
60% of executives, CEOs, COOs, were saying, we have the best program. It's fantastic. 13% of HR managers said, we don't think there's a program. That we have a good program. Most of them were saying, we don't think we have a program at all. Right. So if you go up to me, Damon, I won't pick on you here because you've had a culture for so long of learning, but you go and you say, you know, hey, Damon, do your people get every tool that they possibly want? He's going to give me his vision. Yes, of course they do. Yes, they do. Everyone that works here that wants to upskill to benefit themselves and the company gets it. There's a good chance if I went to an individual contributor that just started and I said, what's a learning and development program at Learnit? They might come back and be like, I don't know, or it wasn't part of onboarding, or there's this course that I missed because I didn't want to pay for it myself. And we see that with especially technology companies all the time. The other piece to getting the data that matters to the employees and to the managers to make sure it fits what they want is kind of being able to align what the C-suite spends their money on. So we're not a huge proponent by way of coming into the market of having sunk costs in spending. So if you're spending money on a platform or a tool or a content provider and your employees aren't using it, there's no activation rate, there's no utilization, there's no certificates, there's no skills, there's no positive feedback, that's tough. And that's really, really difficult for the C-suite to invest in. We aligned our business model around what most of our learning partners do, which is it's utilization-based. When people actually need the resource, they'll go out, they'll find it, they'll get it. And if it's a great resource, it'll become more popular in a marketplace. If it's not a great resource, it won't be recommended as much. And it turns out companies are already spending a lot of this money, but at the division and team level. Reimbursements for conferences, reimbursements for, you know, $100 webinars that folks may go to, but it's not categorized under learning. And that is how modern day workforces are learning.
In doing some of my research, I heard you speak to this and I really liked it. You talked about, you know, kind of assessing the needs beforehand. And this kind of goes back to the first piece where you have, you use Learnit as an organization. You can ask me this, you know, somebody in the C-level, because you have the C-level, then you have the HR and middle management maybe who's, you know, responsible, accountable for the training program. And then you have the individual contributors. And a lot of times what I heard you say before is there's a big disconnect between the vision of what the executives want and what the individual contributors demand. And can you speak to a little bit about your ideas of one of the ways to assess is speak to a couple of the maybe 10 of the new hires that just came on and figuring out what they're needing.
Yeah. I think the most interesting thing is that disconnect. And that's where we're seeing a lot of the data flow in, right? So the more money you spend on learning development, that should impact what people want and they're getting. But you tend to only know if it's a miss when the person leaves. And we know that because one of three reasons that people are leaving companies, especially the younger generation, Gen Z and millennial, is because of learning and development opportunities they don't have, they don't see. So just because you spend $5,000 a person on learning and development and you reimburse for tuition and you have a stipend doesn't mean it's hitting the mark. And the unfortunate part is that when people leave and they walk out and they're interviewed the right way, they'll say, I didn't see the opportunity, or I've missed this stuff, or I wasn't expecting it, so I didn't really know. I think what's great, and you mentioned about the crop of new hires, the talent that you want always has to be learning, right? And they always have to be staying on top of things because things are moving so quickly. If you can assess that during the recruiting process, if you can bring folks on board, and as a CEO, COO, someone in charge of team building in general, you can go in on day one and say, hey, 10 folks that just joined the company, did you have a good understanding of our program? How important was it in your decision? And where do you want to go with it? Like, what's the next thing you're taking advantage of to do that? Because it matters. You're going to get a good sense of it. If you get a lot of blank stares, we didn't ask about it, we don't know what to do, what is professional development? You may be missing the recruiting, but you also may be missing the onboarding and kind of where you're getting people to. So it's an interesting thing that can be solved. I think the best indicator I've ever seen, it's happened to me and it's happened to other operators, is if you're promoting a professional development program and you recruit someone into your company, the best sign that you can have is before they start, that person's reaching out to gain access to learning and training tools. Yeah. Not just learning the product, but like, I'd like to take a course to learn how to sell. I'd like to brush up on my Excel skills. Do you have something I can use instead of paying for it? That to me, just that signals they're already in the game for my company and they're learning so quickly. And yeah, I better have an answer, right? I can't say no, just find what you need and we'll see you on day one. And so the ideal state is really well known. Getting there is a little bit tougher.
So Steve, you have so many great insights in this position that you're in, because you created this unique, you know, place in the marketplace, and to see what's making a difference. What advice would you have for companies like ours, you know, the one that Dame and I work at, like a training company? What do you think helps companies that are out there trying to provide training? Like, what really helps them succeed from your vantage point?
It's a great question. We always lean into high quality training, right? And we give a lot of individual choice to employees. There's a lot of control for the company, but there's a lot of choice for the employees. They go towards high quality content because it's not always about the dollars spent. It's about the time they're spending learning, right? So the duration of time that I spend, there has to be a benefit for me. Obviously, there's an opportunity I'm pushing off, whether it's, you know, getting more into the work or next week's projects or off time that I'm practicing. I think from the level that we see it at, when we work with companies' learning development budgets, we get to see where every dollar and cent goes to every provider, every course, and with that, why the employee thinks it's important for them. So in our system, someone requests a tool from their manager and they'll have to write why, right? I need this for a client project, meant to do this last year. I need this soft skill. I've been given feedback, whatever it is. Typically, what we see is when we provide that feedback and we give visibility to the people operations or HR managers that we're serving at the company, they're typically surprised at one, how quick their folks are getting upskilled, and two, what they're getting upskilled on. So the newest trends of what people need to keep up with are not actually designated by HR. In fact, HR and executives figure it out like 6 months later, and then they search for a tool, and a year later, they kind of have a tool. The employees are the ones signaling what works best. And because I'm a 23-year-old financial analyst that just joined this company, I'm a high performer, I'm going to find the best quality content for that new Excel pivot table that I need to learn, right? And I'm going to do it, and I'm actually going to teach my company. Was there? So when we talk to learning providers, we have the data from what employees are think are best, and it tends to be 6 months ahead of what companies say, ah, yes, we should provide more training on that. And that's what they
say. I love this idea, Damon, that we actually should reach out to our learners to say, here's what they want, and then go to the point of contact and say, this is actually what your people want. Like, anticipate.
I think that's really, really, I love what Steve was just saying about how sometimes the C-level or managers are thinking 6 months out, but the learners are like, this is what I need to do, not even just do my job now, but thrive at doing my job. So Steve, we're in June of 2024. Any insights on what is some of the data showing you? What are like the 3 to 5 skills or topics that are most your learners are looking for or requiring?
Yeah, I'll talk about the top three. The first has to do with artificial intelligence, and not in the traditional way of just using, what's that? Yeah. So people have been upskilling this in different ways. Now we actually see companies, again, maybe 6 months to a year later, creating in our system what they call pathways, which are the best AI resources to help people upskill. And I'll say it's for everyone at the company, right? So the important part to learn is that it's for marketers, it's for financial folks, it's for executives, it's for engineers, certainly. Everyone across the board is upskilling on that stuff and needs to know it. And there's so many great tools out there for doing it. Number two has to do with managerial soft skills. First-time managers thrown into a remote hybrid environment that have never managed people, they're asking for it. Those managers make more noise than the individual contributors do when they're, you know, in their first days. And so companies are reaching out now and saying, we're seeing a spike in this. What are the best books, courses, coaches? What can we provide to help people manage better? That's going to make a business line impact. And then third, and not surprisingly, business applications. Excel, PowerPoint, Google Slides, all of that stuff is moving so quickly, and you're expected to know it when you get to the company. But if I've been working on Keynote for a while, and then I get thrown into a company that deals with Microsoft on PowerPoint, I'm expected to know it day one. So everyone across the board is getting upskilled on business applications just to keep up with the tech stack at their own company. That's been a very consistent number three outside of any peaks and valleys that we've seen.
AI, managerial soft skills, business applications. So in some ways, we could be like heading into like almost a golden age of learning, because sure, people are busy, but AI, it actually is providing some good opportunity for us and a business like yours to help it so that people are getting the training that they need in the moment that they need it, the way that they need it delivered. That can be all very exciting, but this is like an AI, you know, Nostradamus predict the future kind of thing. I'm sort of worried there'll be this all of a sudden this moment where it's like, oh, his learning was great. And then all of a sudden actually, oh, I don't have a job anymore because now AI just does it. So what do you think is going
to
happen?
Yeah. Look, I go back to the typewriter and the PC and all these things that came into our lives. The MacBooks and PCs and Lenovos that we have in front of us are so powerful. The information age is upon us, and we're into like a new information age. But those who learned the PC and figured it out quickly and knew that other companies were building on it were the ones that got to where they wanted to be. So if you wanted to sit in front of a computer and use your brain all day, which I do, and most people I interact with are kind of striving for, you had to upskill on that. The folks that said the typewriter's never going away, the only skill that I need is right in front of me, and someone's going to continue to ask me to do this, tend to have their job not be there when they expect, right? It might be 5-10 years down the road, but we see people getting ahead of AI, and business models get better, they get more effective, and our economy grows. I think the most interesting stat I've seen is from 2017 to 2022, in that 5-year span, the number of skills you needed to work in the US economy went from 10 to about 20. So you needed to double your skills. The original 10 skills are kind of falling off. You needed 10 new skills to be relevant for that job. I see that exponentially growing, right? So in 5 years from now, I wouldn't expect to need maybe 4 times the amount of skills, better managerial skills, people skills, new applications that are coming out, new CRMs I need to keep up with, new ways of marketing and looking for channels. That's going to exponentially grow. AI is going to help us get there quicker, but they can't replace the human that has the skills to know how to work well with it. And that's at the end of the day, what a skill is, right? I know something well. And if I have the drive to be productive, I'm going to get there quicker than anybody else.
Going back to your top three list, which, you know, the AI, there's a great study. You've probably seen it, came out recently, I think May 2024, between Microsoft and LinkedIn, about work trends. And they said that in the next 12 months, 25% of companies will be investing in AI training in some form for their team. So that's for all our listeners out there. I think that's important to know. One thing I wanted to hit on before, you know, before we wrap up is looking at it from, let's say I'm a HR manager and I want to go out and roll out a training program. Steve, what are some core KPIs that I should set with my, let's say my CFO who's writing the check or, you know, creating the reimbursement fund so that I could set and be very clear on that when the training program has come to, not, I don't want to say a completion, but it's time for renewal or something, that we can go back and say, these are what we said at the beginning, and here's how we measured against it.
Yeah, perfect. And all of it, right, especially this day and age, is going to come down to budget and budget management. So how far can you go with this budget, right? CFO knows, wants to know, and cares about all of that stuff. I think when it comes down for us, the main tangible things that you're looking for in the first year of an upskill program have to do with activation, who knows about it, who's interested in it, utilization, who's on it, who's taking content, who's getting through the content, business impact that can be surveyed through managers, employees about productivity and everything else, and the feeling towards it. So are we recruiting better? Are we retaining better? Those can kind of put a learning program into place. And notice we're not even talking about, can I take someone from level one to level three in skills? Because that is what I'll call not secondary, but it's hard to get in the first level with the tools that are out there in this world. The ability to manage that budget and say, here's what we're getting out of that is important. Going into renewals, level two, level three in the next years, you're looking for internal promotions. You're looking for churn rate. You're looking for even the front end of recruiting. How many people are accepting my offers because I'm promoting that we have a program, and anybody who leaves is telling them we have a program, right? So that's kind of the culture that gets built in that has secondary and tertiary effects going into having a program for more than a year. Typically, what we see is a pretty low bar. Hey, we have $100,000. We spent it on a platform. We can't get everyone to sign on. No one knows it exists. And so we'll try to communicate harder, right? That's missing the mark. You want to pull demand from your employees. $100,000. Here's how far it went. Average employee gets 4 to 5 resources per year. They're finishing those resources. They're getting the skills. Managers approve. Let's go into level two. Let's figure out the next steps, how to really drive the culture on the front end and back end of the employee experience.
Awesome. Steve, I got a question for you. Ready? Here it comes. What are you learning right now?
That's a great question. I'm big on strengthening things that you really like from an intrinsic motivation perspective. I really love things like negotiation.
Yeah.
Right. So I just took an executive ed course at Columbia, 2-day smash course in negotiations. And I love learning from other people, right? So it's not purely a lecture. There's people in finance, there's people in marketing everywhere across the board. And I think that helps you in life too, when you go to buy a car or a house. Yeah. So that's there. And then on the managerial soft side, which I get into, my consistent kind of path has to do with learning about the HR industry in podcasts like this. And then Harvard Business Review and The Economist. I want to learn a little bit about the world to stay fresh. And it's a good conversation maker in the business world. And Harvard Business Review just does a good job of showcasing data for what managers are now looking for. And not for nothing, but in the past bunch of years, they've been looking at the employee experience because of the tight labor market. And so I love having a little bit of everything in different formats to make sure I'm hitting my year-end goals of just being better. The stuff like Excel and PowerPoint, yeah, I push off, but I do have goals and I do get certificates every year. It just tends to come in December.
I think you want
to... Hey, Steve, I want to say, and I meant to mention this at first, you know, congratulations on being a new dad.
Yeah.
And, you know, from somebody who went and bragged about reading 40 to 50 books a year, blah, 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 me, you know, and reading.
Yeah.
Good luck with all the learning, man.
I know. I was going to say, I think you left off learning how to change diapers as one of your latest things you learned. Yeah.
No, it's what were we going to say?
Oh, no, I have a good teacher. My wife's awesome. We got parents nearby. Also, you have no choice. And by the way, that learning is inflexible as possible. So 2 a.m, I'm learning how to change a different diaper in a different style. I enjoy it when I look back, but if you ask me at 2 a.m, I was probably pretty comfy.
Yeah, I wrote a, from a 6-year-old and a 3-year-old, I wrote a blog on my side, talk about how busy professionals continue to learn. Because I love what you're saying about, you know, the economist and doing all these different things. It's just getting creative and finding the time to do it, which typically for me is now 5 o'clock in the morning, or whenever you can get a little learning opportunity. I think anybody can benefit from this. Before we wrap up, give us 1 or 2 tips that you learned about becoming a better negotiator in your session you just got out of.
Ah, cool. So I think the overarching thing that you'll kind of see is it's easier to negotiate with someone who knows about negotiation, right? So if there's a disconnect and relationship issue, that's going to be a problem. So the more you know about negotiation and the counterparty does, the more you understand it's a win-win deal, right? Yeah. Negotiation doesn't have to be a loss-loss. And in our business world, where we have reputations, you're trying to grow the pie before cutting it up. And then, you know, as a secondary level, like, you know, the easy psychology behind anchoring. And if you have a lot of information and you think you have more than the other party, anchoring to something that's better to you, because psychologically, it's hard to roll that back is important. And look, I learn all I want. I work with a lot of professionals. I also tried to buy a car 2 weeks ago and I got completely outmatched. So the difference had to do with this person does it for a living and they sell 5 cars a day, buy 1 car every 5 years. And the tactics and the strategies and the hand me coffee at the right time and make me test drive.
Sure.
I was overwhelmed. So there's
like,
you know, one class to kind of figure it out, a lifetime to master. I think that's why learning it is so fun.
Yeah. You got to be careful.
Go ahead. I just want to say, what is anchoring? Just so the audience knows, what is anchoring?
Yeah. So if you're, if David, you and I are exchanging on a car, right? And I say, hey, I would love for you to buy my car. You say, great. And there's all kinds of case examples they give with like an older car that doesn't look like it has value, but it's an antique. So it's actually worth more. So if I know my car and I do research, I look up Kelly Blue Book, I know what it's worth, I know what the market's worth, and I think I have more information, I'm not going to let you make the first offer. I'm going to anchor it high. So the highest value I can get is 30,000. I will offer that to you. You may think the car is worth 15,000, but when I say 30, inherently you're going to say, oh, the value is actually closer to 30 than I thought. And now we're negotiating on my 30K mark. Your next offer may be 25 or so, right? Whereas if you start and you say 15K, in my head, I go, okay, well, he's only going to be a buyer if I get down to that level. Can I get to that level? Okay, 20K, right? And where are we? And just 100% of the time, I think the core instruction was the best offer you can make for yourself, right? The highest price in this case, if I'm selling the car, that keeps someone at the table. So if you walk away, I've done the wrong stuff. 30K, blow it off, no worries. But if I can, you know, reasonably say this car's worth 30,000 and keep you at the table, the rest of negotiations is in my hands. And so that's for pure, you know, one-to-one win-loss kind of negotiations, the simple ones.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause if you go too high, then it looks like, you know, you're talking about it backfires. So there's like a ceiling for like how high you should go. And it's also kind of flies in the face of old advice about should you like go in first or not. But with somebody who's trying to sell you a car, it's not win-win anymore, right? It's like now you got to switch.
And I can tell you the Subaru dealer got the best of me, and what they advertise on TV comes with taxes and fees. And I actually said this, the acronym that you learned there, ZOPA, zone of potential agreement. Mm-hmm. And so where between Darren, you and I might actually agree.
Yeah.
And I said, my ZOPA's here and you need to get there. And they don't care. They do this for a living and they moved everything, all the measuring sticks on me. But it's fascinating. Intellectually speaking, and obviously at the core end of it, the better of a relationship you have and the trust you have, you'll get to a better agreement to everyone. And I think that's the fun part about learning.
That's right. I mean, we totally pivoted our negotiation class away from that sort of hard boiled, you know, lawyers duking it out kind of thing to win-win. Cause that's what people need to do day in and day out in their lives. That's really the main thing, and being able to pivot to what's that interest versus position I think is so, it's valuable every single day in almost every conversation you have.
It's interesting. If you go overseas to a ton of countries, especially the ones that aren't as developed as the West, everything's negotiable, yeah. Right? So people inherently get it. And there's different cultures around it. But if I went into a grocery mart in Cairo, where I've been and kind of learned this lesson, if the dish detergent says, four dirhams on it or pounds, I think they use, that's negotiable. And they expect that, even though it's on the ticket price. Mm-hmm. The U.S., yeah. There's cultures around it, but I guarantee if you ask for something, there's a chance that it's negotiable. And so you always, put on a lens of that, and it serves you well in your personal life too.
It's good. You talk about negotiation all day long.
I love it. I think
we sit here and talk to Steve all day long. It's been very fascinating. Steve, one signature question that we do have is, tell us something about you that most people are unaware of.
Something that might surprise folks.
I'm trying to think of something that would be interesting.
I'll give you a little thinking time here. Damon always makes fun of me, but like one person said that they were like kind of a hobby meteorologist on the side. Yeah. I'm always looking for that person who says, I'm going to Trekkie conventions or something. I don't know.
Yeah. No, interesting. I think, Damon, it goes to our past. I've taken up softball quite a bit to the point where, I look forward to it all of the time, but my attitude throughout the week, definitely on Sundays, is based on whether we win or lose.
I love it.
So, it's my team currently makes fun of me when we get on a Monday morning call because I always have an injury. This week it's a calf injury. Last week I dove, so I had a rib injury. But I love staying active and like the sports stuff. If I can chase a ball like in the outfield and not have to think about business, about stresses, about whether Home Depot is going to deliver the right thing at the right time, right? Like the average owner say, it's awesome. So most people around me know that fact, but if you don't catch me on a Sunday, it's probably because I'm out on some dirt field in New Jersey running around.
That's great. Steve, how do people get in touch with you and One Range? What's the best way?
Awesome. OneRange.co. My personal email is steve@onerange.co. We just love talking and learning about upskilling programs, what you are doing for your employees, what you intend to do for your employees. And we have tons of resources. We write about this stuff all the time in our blog section. So we'd love to hear from you.
Awesome. Some of the stuff we covered today, just to recap, knowledge workers, it's different in terms of attacking goals than you might think, even, from like sports or military, something like that. When you're trying to serve knowledge workers, you got to update old mentalities, got to get out of the days of the fins on the cars and start meeting people where they are with the training they need and the way that they want it delivered, and that's possible and that you can provide it and you can measure it for success. These tools exist out there. Provide that high quality training for your people and see the benefits. Steve, it was great having you on the show. Thank you so much for being here. To our listeners, if you liked the episode, please hit like and subscribe. Until then, please stay curious and keep learning.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you so much.